From KCRW, this is Left, Right, and Center.
President Trump is in Europe for the G20 summit. In Poland, he spoke in defense of the West, portraying Islamist terrorism as a successor threat to communism. In Germany, he had a private meeting with Vladimir Putin, very private, bringing just Secretary of State Rex Tillerson and a translator. They talked for over 2 hours, longer than expected, and Vladimir Putin denied Russian interference in our election. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. We'll discuss all that, plus we'll talk with conservative author Henry Olson, who says the right gets Ronald Reagan all wrong, and we'll ask the pollsters Margie O'Meara and Kristen Soltis Anderson whether the public should approve of them. We're excited about our first official one-hour show, but first, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Welcome to our first official one-hour Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. And our special guest is Juliette Kayyem. She's a lecturer at the Harvard Kennedy School and former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security. Welcome, everybody. We have a lot to get to this week, including President Trump's meeting with Vladimir Putin within the context of the broader G20 international summit. But first, I want to talk about Trump's speech in Warsaw, where he visited before traveling to the G20 in Hamburg. In the speech, Trump spoke of the bonds of culture, faith, and tradition that hold the West together, and of the need for Western nations to stand together against external threats. He extolled the NATO alliance, and unlike when he went to Belgium in May, he made an explicit commitment to uphold the Article 5 mutual defense provision of the NATO treaty. As such, this speech has been drawing praise from foreign policy conservatives like Bill Kristol, who've often been critical of the president. What did you think, Rich? Did this please you more than his past speeches?
Yeah, I thought it was a tremendous speech. I think it was easily the best speech he's given as president. Just as craftsmanship, it was actually well written, which very few of his speeches have been, and is actually an enjoyable read. And it wasn't, you know, an American first speech. It was nationalistic in the sense that it emphasized the importance of free and sovereign nations and augmented that theme through moving evocations of Polish history or Polish nationality as one of the wonders of Europe. This is a nation that lost its territory and then eventually won it back and was sandwiched between the Germans and the Soviets, which was a horrendous experience. And he talked about Western values and freedom and free inquiry and the importance of civilizational will and self-confidence. So I think this is one of those speeches, if anyone else had given it, the praise would almost have been universal, but there are a lot of critics who find a reason to freak out about almost anything.
Well, so this is, I've seen two main lines of criticism against this speech, and the first one that's come widely from the left has been that, as Peter Beinart at The Atlantic said, he said the speech reflected, quote, racial and religious paranoia, and he saw it as framing an implicitly white Christian West against what Trump was calling threats from the South and the East. And so people were seeing this still as, you know, as within what they see as a white nationalist frame, even though it's not in the America First framing he's been seeing before. And Katrina,
I agree with Peter Beinart. What struck me is, first of all, echoes of Trump's inaugural address. You could feel Steve Bannon's Paul Prince all over this. But I'm struck because a 2003 George W. Bush spoke in Poland. He referred to democracy 13 times. Trump mentioned it once. And there's a reason. Ideologically, what links the U.S. government and the Polish government and some of the other sort of authoritarian governments around the world is not the commitment to democracy, but Poland and the United States, Trump's United States, increasingly authoritarian. There's a hostility to Muslim immigration. There's a hostility to a kind of contract, a compact for security and freedom, if you define that by healthcare and other needs, human needs. So I thought there was a kind of clash of civilizations quality to this speech that defined it, and an odd incoherence to it, because he then goes on to meet Putin, but he wants to show his mettle when it comes to Russia by, you know, standing in Poland, which is increasingly authoritarian and also pitted against Russia. So I found it odd, and I think it was fourth-rate warmed over Reaganism. And in that context, I disagree with Rich.
Julia,
but, I like fourth-rate Reaganism. That's the difference between us.
I think first-rate when he reaches his hand out to for détente, I will take, or is an acolyte of Franklin D. Roosevelt, but not fourth-rate warmed over.
Julia, what did you think of this? I mean, NATO is fundamentally a Western alliance in that it consisted of nations west of the Soviet Union, now nations west of Russia. It feels to me like, you know, there ought to be ways to talk about the West that would seem normal and appropriate. But as Rich notes, because of the reputation that Donald Trump has developed and the comments he's made in the past, people look at this askance and I think have reasons to look at it askance.
Yeah, and I think the criticisms of the speech are fair, given the context of who Donald Trump is. I mean, you just don't take a single speech and pretend like he hasn't been arguing a lot of very sort of nationalistic, you know, isolationist rhetoric. But I'm going to give credit where credit is due. Article 5 was an important moment. It should have been stated much earlier, a commitment to Article 5, but I think it's important that it was stated. It was stated publicly. It was stated for audiences that were very, very nervous about an emerging Trump doctrine and what it meant. So that is an important part. It also laid out, for those of us who are waiting to determine whether what policies are going to come out of the White House, something of the nature of a Trump doctrine, less transactional than people like me tend to think. Maybe there is some notion of defense of nations and democracies. Where I will criticize the president just taking the speech in isolation is there's a lot about defense of nations from these external threats, you know, terrorism, immigrants, whoever. And that's fair. I don't think those are existential threats like nuclear Armageddon. There was a lot less on how to nurture what makes these democracies great. And I think that's an important thing also to say, that it's easy to defend something, but how do you actually nurture the thing you want to defend? And that's the piece that I think it's fair to criticize the president on.
I think even if he just said, did you say he said democracy once? I haven't done a count, but he repeatedly says freedom and talks about defending freedom. And I really reject the idea that defending Western civilization is exclusionary. I mean, if the West isn't going to defend Western civilization, who's going to do it? And one of the wonderful attributes of Western civilization is that it's open, so you can come here and become part of it. And also its values have proven, thank God, quite susceptible to export. So you have a country like Japan, that's part of a different civilization, but it is significantly westernized and better for it. Now, I do think, obviously, there's something to the criticism, well, it's Donald Trump saying this. Does he really believe it? Does he really know it? But when it comes to political sincerity, I'm kind of part of the school of fake it till you make it, you know?
But I think
have him give a good speech. That's better than giving a bad speech. And once he's said it, it's harder to back off. And if he says it enough, maybe he might forget that he didn't initially believe it.
You're a believer in words are also deeds. But, you know, there's another freedom is a contested term in our country's history and the world's history. And I think one measure of freedom is giving people lives of purpose and dignity. The other, you talk about an open society. President Trump's vision of this country does not seem to be that open. I mean, it is, we've disagreed, but he supports closing borders as opposed to opening, closing the country to millions as opposed to opening. And I think that term, freedom, as I said, is contested. On the Article 5, you know, the history of NATO, I will not go into that, but there is a fundamental geopolitical paradox to NATO. It's an institution which exists almost to manage the risks it has created. It was designed as a military institution to counter the Soviet threat, and on so many levels, a different security architecture in Europe would have been far more nurturing of what Juliet speaks of, which is a democratic as opposed to a more militarized terrain and more equipped to deal with the humanitarian crises which the G20 must confront in its meetings.
I think a difficulty about how to interpret this speech is what does Trump think the West is and what does he think its values are? I mean, as Katrina notes, he went to Poland, which has regressed on press freedom, on the independence of its judiciary, did not take the opportunity to criticize the Poles for that. In fact, sort of commiserated with the president of Poland about how unfair the media is. But then the other question for me is Russia part of the West for Donald Trump, or is Russia an antagonist to the West? There was a line in the speech critical of Russia's destabilization in Ukraine, but, you know, a lot of the president's alt-right admirers really, you know, share his apparent affection for Vladimir Putin, see cultural connections between the U.S. and Russia. So I guess one of the questions is, you know, if he's here to defend Western values, what are those values? How central is press freedom and democracy and those sorts of things there? It seems like if that was the thrust of his speech, then it cozying up to this Polish government that doesn't really live up to all of those values doesn't seem to follow through on that.
Well, just in the text of the speech, he defines Western values as free inquiry, as celebrating brilliance and innovation. And he calls out Russia, one, its depredations in Ukraine, two, calls on it to join the community of responsible nations. And the reference to emerging threats from the South and the East, I think East is clearly a reference to Russia. And Russia isn't part of Western civilization, but it's another country that you want to westernize.
That is a debate that has gone on for hundreds of years in Russia. Are you suggesting that Tolstoy and Chekhov and Dostoevsky?
But
Russia may well turn east if there's an ongoing Cold War. But Russia is both east and west, and the hope for Ukraine to survive as a viable democratic, viably economic system is a bridge between east and west.
I think it's on the periphery of the West and has Western aspects, but it's not France or Germany. And, you know, a key kind of going way back, a key marker of the West is sort of the legacy from Rome and the Catholic Church and sort of Christendom and Orthodox Christianity, obviously related to that, but a step removed.
I mean, then what do you do with presidents, I think Republican presidents, who invited Russia to join NATO? That fell apart,
that would
but
be
that
wonderful.
Would be considering that, Russia a member of the West.
But that would be great. And that's, again, just not to belabor, but Turkey is an example. Ataturk wanted to westernize Turkey.
Yeah, east
it
and
seemed
west.
As though
but
Turkey
don't consign
become,
it just
it
to
seems
the east.
Though Turkey become fully part of the West and possibly join the EU, and now it's taken a step back.
Juliet, do you see a coherent theory of the West in this speech?
I'm going to say it again. Let's not underestimate how important it was for the Europeans to hear the United States' commitment to Article 5. Whether we like the architecture or not, that omission was in previous statements by President Trump was a big deal. And so I do think, to the extent that there's sort of a bipartisan national security policy, I do think that they won in that piece of the speech. So to me, this is great, right? In other words, because the failure of President Trump to say it in the past made me exceptionally nervous, like existentially nervous. I thought, what the heck is going on here? I will, though, go back to, why the Russians in particular would actually have heard what they wanted to hear in this speech as well. So if the Europeans are happy with the commitment to NATO, the Russians, because of President Trump's sort of failure to describe, or as I was saying earlier, nurture what it means to be free, right? And a lot of us in the middle and on the left and on the right believe that it means open press. It means acceptance of diversity. It means a whole bunch of sort of pluralistic policies. I think that the Russians will be happy with those omissions in the speech.
Well, let us know what you thought about Trump's speech on our Facebook page or message us on Twitter. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, more on Trump's trip to Europe, and we'll be talking with Henry Olson about his new book, Reevaluating Ronald Reagan. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with our first official full hour Left, Right, and Center. I am Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. Later on today, pollsters Kristen Soltis-Anderson and Margie O'Meara will discuss the state of polling. After so many surprise elections, are survey numbers still reliable? But now I'm back with this week's panel. On the left is Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation. On the right is Rich Lowry of National Review. And Juliet Kayyem of the Harvard Kennedy School is also with us. So after Trump stopped off in Poland, he went on to Hamburg for the main purpose of his trip, the G20 summit of major world powers. The president had a one-on-one meeting with German Chancellor Angela Merkel. The two were pictured smiling broadly afterward. In the public portion of a meeting with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto, Trump was asked whether he still wants Mexico to pay for the wall. He said, absolutely. But the most watched aspect of Trump's time at the G20 was his meeting with Vladimir Putin, a meeting that ran quite long, 2 hours and 16 minutes, more than twice as long as it was supposed to be. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said ahead of the summit that he hoped to reach an agreement with Russia on working together in Syria in an effort to stop the Russian-backed Assad government and U.S.-backed rebels from fighting over territory where ISIS is losing its grip on control. And the AP has indeed reported that there will be a ceasefire in Syria starting on Sunday between the two sides, though I would note this is the fifth ceasefire we've seen in this conflict, so we'll see how long that persists. Of course, there is that other big set of issues between the U.S. and Russia. The day before the meeting, Trump again muddied the water on the issue of Russian interference in last year's election, saying he thought Russia probably interfered, but other people may have done so as well. Juliet, what do you make of these efforts on the U.S. and Syria trying to forge an agreement basically on how to, you know, divide up territory in the country and reach a ceasefire?
It's a really important start, one that was attempted by Secretary Kerry. And now it looks like this is the sort of dominance or at least the rise of Secretary Tillerson, who really wanted to leave this meeting with a ceasefire. As you said, Josh, we don't know the details, so I'm going to be really cautious here. But it does appear that the ceasefire will have some sort of negotiated settlement on areas where ISIS is leaving, because that vacuum, what you don't want is that vacuum to be refilled by ISIS or ISIS Part 8 or ISIS Part 9. What we don't know now are two things. What did the United States agree to? And this is a question out there right now. The Trump administration had originally come on board saying they wanted Assad out. They had no future in Syria. I think that's been tempered, and I will admit to you, I think rightfully so. I think the more that we focus on getting Assad out, the less likely it was that we could at least stabilize some peace. But that means, secondly, it is likely in this proxy war between Russia and the United States that Russia did get more out of the proxy war than we did, that Russia's presence in Syria will be, as well as Assad, their person, will be sustainable and long-lasting. So that's what we know out of this right now. And so some pieces that I think will be in the very least important to the Syrian people, because in the end, a ceasefire isn't just about Russia and the United States. It's actually about the Syrians who are victimized.
One thing that's interesting to me here is that the chemical attacks in Syria is one of the few things that President Trump has talked about in sort of soaring moral terms during his presidency. He seemed personally affected by, you know, the attacks on children there. And he made these comments, basically, that Assad can have no part in governing Syria. But it seems that we're likely to agree to that. And for reasons that Juliet points out, it sort of seems like we have no option other than to agree to that.
Yeah, when he said that, he was acting in a long tradition of American presidents writing rhetorical checks that they couldn't cash, especially in Syria. And the fact is, I don't like it, but Assad has effectively won this stage of the civil war. And Russia has, as Juliet rightly points out, has helped him save his regime and significantly strengthen his position. And any negotiated settlement, unfortunately, is going to reflect that reality. Again, I don't like that reality, but I don't want to fight a war with Russia over it.
But I also think Juliet spoke in humane terms. I mean, the ceasefire will stabilize a country, assist civilians who've been the brunt, who've borne the brunt of this horrific war. I think it's important to step back, and this show does that well. So much of the media, it seems to me, has been the spectacle of the Trump-Putin meeting. Will they body slam each other? What's their handshake going to be like? But this summit gathering comes at a time of the greatest divide between the United States and Russia, wider now than at any point since Cold War I. So I think one needs to step back, whatever one thinks of Trump or Putin, and think also of the danger of nuclear escalation. Former Clinton Defense Secretary William Perry has said we're closer to nuclear catastrophe than at any time since Cold War I. And blissfully, a lot of Americans seem unaware of that. So there are a whole set of issues: Syria, nuclear escalation, loose nukes, North Korea, and also, you know, cyber. Cyber is discussed in the context of attacks on our elections. Foreign interference in elections is inappropriate, is unacceptable. But there's news today that there have been attempted hacks of nuclear utilities. I think what's lost is the need for a long-term strategy regarding cyber war. You could see cyber attacks on command and control systems or strategic arsenals. So I think it's not a bad idea to revive and look back at the 2015 cyber treaty, which was scuttled, I think, partly by the Obama administration.
Juliet, Should we read in anything into the very small cadre of officials that was in this meeting? From our side, it was just Trump and Rex Tillerson and a translator and a similar team of three from the Russian side. There had been some discussion ahead of the meeting about whether Trump would bring Fiona Hill into this meeting. Yeah. She's the top Russia staffer at the National Security Council, viewed as one of the key Russia hawks inside the administration. But then it turned out that not only was she not in this meeting, even her boss, H.R. McMaster, was not in this meeting. And that's even though the Russians were said to have wanted a larger group of officials. What do you think it means that Trump wanted to keep this meeting so small?
I think that the Trump administration is very nervous about leaks and so kept it small because they're nervous about what I think their principal might do or say. Remember the last meeting with the Russian foreign minister and ambassador, it became relatively clear moments after that President Trump had thrown Comey under the bus, had maybe disclosed Israeli intelligence assets and ISIS. We don't know the specifics on that. But I will say, better Tillerson than Jared Kushner, right? I mean, in some ways, this started to look kind of normal, right? Oh, my gosh, there's this Secretary of State. You can say what you want about him, but that looks like there's, a system here, even though the expertise on our side of the ledger was about, less than a year in government as compared to Putin and his team. But I think it's important to remember that our relationship with Russia should not be viewed in binary terms, like we can progress on some things, but therefore, can't criticize others. I refuse to sort of put aside at this stage the aspects of the Russia-U.S. relationship related to our democratic processes, because now I think President Trump's failure to actually be able to finish a sentence without caveats saying, yes, Russia was involved in hacking of our elections, really has turned him into an enabler of Russia in 2018 and 2020. I think it is safe now to say that he has enabled Putin because there's been really no conversation from what we can tell, at least right at the moment we're taping right now, about greater sanctions, naming and shaming, all the things that we could do to protect our system. So while I am hopeful for détente, for cyber agreements, all that stuff, for me, the protection of our democratic systems is the first, right? I mean, in other words, it is the thing that we have to address.
Trump's been doing this funny thing, though, right? Because he keeps, not being willing to quite say that the Russians were behind the hacking. But then he says, I don't know who was behind it, and why didn't Obama do anything about it?
Yeah. No, that's fine. I mean, look, that is totally – that's a totally fair criticism. I get that, although I think it's somewhat, sort of misses the sanctions in the last waning days of the Obama administration. And look, that is going to be debated forever. What I know and what we know is that President Trump will be president in 2018 and for a reelect in 2020. And if you are the Russians – are you nervous about any attempt by this administration to protect our democratic processes? The answer is absolutely no. And so we can go back and relitigate, but we can fix this. In other words, we've learned from France. We've learned from Germany. We have capabilities to push back on the Russians, protect our systems on the local and state level. There are things we can do. Do you think anyone is doing them? Absolutely not.
But we should be. But we should be doing them. What we should be investing is a democracy infrastructure. Let me just step back. I mean, there's a difference between accountability, and Trump steps on his own incoherent head when he tweets these things because he's not letting an independent counsel investigation proceed as it must. There must be accountability. But Juliet, Cold War, if we enter into a deteriorating relationship, is bad for progressives. It's bad for the space for dissent. It's bad for progressive budgets needed to rebuild this country. And it closes down space for dissent. In a country I've been covering for 35 years, in Russia, I've spoken to leading independent news people there, to civil society people, and they need more space. And I think a Cold War clamps down on both sides.
I think when the president says this sort of incoherent thing, the thing he's getting at is that one of the reasons that Barack Obama was not so aggressive domestically about this attack. Now, he did impose the sanctions and whatnot, but it was clear that the president thought that if he was seen making too much noise about this domestically, it would be seen as a domestic political act trying to shore up Hillary Clinton by suggesting that there was a Russian plot to elect Donald Trump. And indeed, Mitch McConnell said to him as much, that if he did this, it would be seen as a partisan action. And for that reason, Barack Obama backed off. And I think Trump looks at that and says, you know, if someone from outside was trying to elect the opposition party in an election that I was dealing with, he would not worry for one second about the idea that he was misusing public institutions. So I think Trump looks at it and sort of is like, that patsy, I can't believe he let Putin get away with
this. Yeah, well, clearly Obama didn't say anything because he feared it would backfire mm-hmm. and hurt Hillary Clinton, one. Mm-hmm. And two, as Trump points out, he thought Hillary was going to win. So yeah. This whole episode would have been, you know, not mm-hmm. that big a deal. But as soon as the election happened, then it became an enormous deal. And Trump is also right in his belief that part of the emotion about around this issue, and I think it's serious and it's horrible and it should be called out, is an effort to undermine his legitimacy. And that's one reason I believe he's just so reluctant to say it. I mean, he should just say it, one, because it's true. Two, as Juliet points out, by not saying it, you're kind of perhaps giving Russia permission the next time. But he's all tangled up because he just doesn't want to admit this because he thinks all the people who are obsessed by it want to undermine and don't really think he was legitimately
elected. And I think substantively, the discredited bipartisan foreign policy establishment has former NATO Ambassador Robert Hunter put it well. There's been an attempt to cripple Trump from achieving a better relationship with Russia if he's capable of it. But the crippling has happened.
I think Trump himself may have been a significant player in that crippling. Let us know what you thought about the G20 summit on our Facebook page or message us on Twitter. That's at LRCKCRW. We're going to take a turn now and talk with Henry Olson. He's a senior fellow at the Conservative Ethics and Public Policy Center, and he has a new book out called The Working Class Republican, Ronald Reagan and the Return of Blue-Collar Conservatism. Henry, let's start with the central thesis of your book, basically, that both liberals and conservatives misunderstand what Reagan's philosophy of government was. So can you tell us, what do we all have wrong about Ronald Reagan?
They left and right, what they think is that Ronald Reagan was basically Barry Goldwater with a winning smile and a pleasing personality, that he was every bit as much opposed to the innovations in national and state government that were launched by the New Deal coalition started by Franklin Roosevelt. And in fact, that's not the case. He had a very different and more restrictive take on what government ought to do than people on the left, both the left, center-left and the farther left. But he was somebody who never went along with the idea that the New Deal ought to be torn out root and branch, and that a world without Social Security and a world without the interstate highway system was a better and freer world. He was, in fact, as I say, a New Deal conservative, somebody who interpreted rather than opposed Roosevelt's basic and core innovations.
Reagan was fond of using this line that basically he didn't leave the Democratic Party, it had left him, and Reagan had been a politically active Democrat from the 1930s to the 1950s. And I think a lot of people took that to basically be rhetoric, but your contention is that he was sincere when he said that he was, you know, remained an admirer of FDR throughout his career and thought that he was pursuing what was, you know, the correct agenda for the New Deal rather than trying to reject it.
Right. That's exactly right. That Reagan would, throughout his career as a conservative, cite FDR approvingly. He would do so overtly. He would do so covertly. He would do so in some ways that I'm not even sure he was aware of. For example, Reagan, throughout his career, talked about that the government ought to support people who, quote, through no fault of their own, unquote, needed our support. Well, that's exactly how Roosevelt referred to people in many of his fireside chats who deserve permanent government support. And we know that Reagan memorized the fireside chats. He listened to them avidly, and he had a photographic memory. He was able to reproduce them for his friends in Iowa and California throughout the Roosevelt presidency. I can't see why people have a hard time grasping that a man who could say throughout his career that he supported these things and emphasize that people who were on the safety net programs as president wouldn't see their programs cut, why he wasn't sincere in that.
So how do we square this with Reagan's policy legacy? Obviously, Reagan was a big tax cutter, but he didn't leave the government substantially smaller than when he started with it. Was there what did he do substantively in terms of the role of government in society?
Well, yeah, what Reagan wanted to do was he always opposed the elements of the New Deal and the elements of the Democratic Party that focused on government as a solution rather than as a helper, the one that focused on government direction of an economy rather than private direction of an economy. And I think Reagan rolled back that element. It's something that the Democratic left continues to fight against, that era of Reagan, the one that made entrepreneurship honorable again, that made business honorable again, is one that's a lasting legacy. I also think that what he did was slow the growth and in some ways halt the growth of non-entitlement programs, that there had been a continued expansion of what we now call non-defense discretionary spending. And Ronald Reagan actually did cut that as a share of the government. That was his major success in rolling back or reducing the size of government. And that remains something that's difficult to do, much to the chagrin of the Democratic left. But I think those two are his major policy legacies. And he never sought to undo the major entitlement legacies of the New Deal. He might interpret what to do with them today differently than people on the left, but he would also interpret what to do with them today differently than people on the Democratic right, precisely because he remained committed to the idea that people who need public support ought to get it, and that was a primary value.
So how does this fit in with Donald Trump? Because one of the big differences between Donald Trump and his opponents in the 2016 election seemed to be his rhetorical commitment to programs like Social Security and Medicare and even Medicaid, which Trump said at the time that he was not going to cut, even though he's now supporting a health care bill that would do so substantially.
I think that was absolutely essential to Trump's victory, that what Trump did, whether by chance or design, was focus on the same sort of voter who we called during Reagan's time Reagan Democrats, the sort of people who are not Republicans, do not support either the business wing of the Republican Party or the movement conservative wing of the Republican Party, but are also out of step with the Democratic left. And he focused on their wants. He focused on their worldview. He said, I love you. I've got your back. And part of that, as we know from many polls, is an undying support for Social Security and Medicare, and to some extent the Medicaid expansion, precisely because they benefit from those programs. Had Donald Trump not done that, I think he would not have received the sort of overwhelming support that gave him the industrial Midwest and hence the White House.
So what does that mean for him politically, then, if this health care bill gets adopted? I go back and forth in my own head about what these voters were expecting out of Donald Trump, whether their primary concern was about making the government work for them, including preserving these programs, or was it more about sort of a restoration of cultural power to people like them? And I think Trump has clearly delivered on the second in a major way. So if he does that, but then he also signs a bill that would significantly cut Medicaid, are these voters going to feel betrayed, or are they going to feel like they got the main thing they were looking for?
I think if he passes a bill that significantly places their health care at risk, he takes a risk with their support. And the same is true with the tax bill, is that he approves a tax reform bill that doesn't give them lower taxes, which is basically what the principles his Treasury Secretary enunciated a couple of months ago would do. He's taking risks with their support. He's creating cross pressures. Do I care more about the fact that he's not helping my livelihood, or do I care more about the fact that he seems to espouse a muscular view of American nationality, which I also like? There's no need for him to take those risks. And given the way he's alienating other aspects of the traditional Republican coalition, high-income, educated business conservatives in particular, he's taking risks with both the Republican brand and with his own reelection that he need not and should not be taking.
We're going to take a quick break and then come back talking with Henry Olson. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. I've been talking with Henry Olson about his new book, The Working Class Republican, Ronald Reagan and the Return of Blue-Collar Conservatism. Let's bring Rich and Katrina back into the conversation. That's on the left, Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation, and on the right, Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. Rich, you reviewed Henry's book. Is he right about Reagan that he was less anti-government than his fans and his detractors think?
Yes and no. I think I love the book, and everyone should read it, and I learned and benefited from it, and I think every Republican should read it, because Henry's right that a lot of Republicans have a false image of Ronald Reagan as a Goldwater-ite libertarian extremist, and he wasn't that. He was a very practical man and a practical politician, and did accept the basic need for a safety net, as Henry argues. Where I would depart with Henry is I think it goes too far to take from that that he was a so-called New Deal Republican. If you read his signature 1964 speech promoting Goldwater's candidacy, it is an attack from beginning to end on all sorts of government programs, even pre-Great Society government programs. And if Ronald Reagan had his druthers, if you put politics aside, would he be in favor of this new, much more stringent funding formula for Medicaid? Yes. Would he be in favor of Paul Ryan's reform of Medicare? Yes. Would he be in favor of significantly privatizing Social Security? Yes. Now, as a practical man, as a practical politician, would he actually support those things? Maybe not. It depends.
Henry, do you think that's right? Would Reagan be for this American Health Care Act?
I think that Reagan would be for aspects of it, but I think what Reagan would do is care more about coverage of people than this bill, at least the Ryan version, did. He said in many of his speeches that he didn't believe that people in the United States should go without needed medical care for lack of funds. And in fact, he repeated that in that 1964 speech on behalf of Barry Goldwater, that I think it's worth conservatives remembering that at the point in the Goldwater speech where he, after the attacks, he says, "Can our liberal friends say that we're always opposed to something, we're never for something?" And when he turns to what conservatives are for, he doesn't talk about liberty, the Constitution, or smaller government. He talks about being for Social Security, being for telling our senior citizens that no one should be denied health care for a lack of funds, being for the United Nations, and being for foreign aid. Those are the things he says conservatives are for. All of those are New Deal innovations or inspired by New Deal philosophy. So I think that understanding the full side of Ronald Reagan, which is to say, how can you be both against some aspects of government and for others, is essential to getting who he was about, what he was about, and why he got support from Reagan Democrats.
I think Henry Olson's book, I've just read an excerpt. I mean, it's an intriguing argument. It offers insight into what the contemporary Republican Party confronts. Reagan's legacy was dual, if not, you know, I mean, he was a supporter of tax cuts for the richest. He was someone who assaulted government. Even if he did believe in Social Security and Medicare, which is a great society program, his words did matter. And what he said when he said government is the problem undercuts the very heart of Roosevelt's New Deal on, you know, on two or three things. At the heart of Roosevelt's New Deal was a 20th century security contract with working people, with the common men, with forgotten men. Unions, labor, was at the heart of that contract. Union busting was at the heart of Reaganism. The Southern strategy was at the heart of Reaganism. And I think that speaks perhaps to Trump's success. I mean, he's played that playbook pretty well in vote suppression, in race baiting. And I think these are elements that one can't forget. On the UN, the United Nations, you're absolutely right. It was a creation of the New Deal in many ways, as was the Four Freedoms. But the assault on the UN under Reagan was a very serious one. So I think it's complicated. And I think it's also hard to talk about the New Deal without talking about its bookend, the Great Society. And within the Great Society, the elements of a social safety net were something that the Reagan coalition put in its crosshairs.
Unfortunately, we're over time, and I'm going to have to leave it there. But Henry, I want to thank you so much for joining us. We're now going to bring in two of our left, right, and center favorites. They are the hosts of the podcast, The Pollsters, and they are their own team of left and right. On the left is Democratic pollster Margie O'Meara. She's the executive vice president at PSB Research. And on the right is Republican pollster Kristen Soltis Anderson. She's a columnist for The Washington Examiner and co-founder of Echelon Insights. Welcome to both of you. So polls have come in for a lot of criticism in the last year after Brexit didn't go the way we expected and the presidential election didn't go the way we expected and the UK parliamentary election didn't go the way we expected. Is polling getting less reliable? Have you guys been screwing up?
I think that pollsters would be among the first to tell you that it is getting harder and harder for us to do our jobs well these days. No longer do we have the sort of consistent way of contacting people that we may have had 20 or 30 years ago when everybody had a landline phone. You know, nowadays, fewer than 46% of households have a landline phone. There's no one single solitary way to reach out and ask people what they think about things. And so that's made it much more just technically complicated dedicated to do our jobs. In addition, you now have news cycles that move very quickly. You have people that have increased skepticism of media outlets and things like that. And so when they get a call on the phone saying, hello, I'm calling from media outlet X, Y, or Z, and I'm conducting a poll. Would you like to tell me your opinions on things? Are people more skeptical of what will happen with that information? I think yes, to an extent. So you have the various problems that we're facing, including the technological changes that make it harder for us to reach people. And I think sort of cultural changes that have sped up the consumption of information and the shifts in the political winds that make it harder for pollsters to accurately capture up to the very moment of Election Day exactly how things will turn out.
And the other thing, too, is thinking about what is included in polling. I mean, so much of what we think about of polling is the horse race, whether or not Clinton is up 0.1 or 2 in one state or another state, when really there is so much of research what goes on behind the scenes is really trying to figure out why people have the points of view that they do, what makes them tick, why they might stay home, why they might vote, what they even know about what's going on a political debate or in a campaign.
Kristen, how should we understand in that context Trump's low poll numbers? His approval numbers are sort of shockingly low for a new president. But first of all, if you ask the president, what he'll tell you is, you know, well, the polls said I was going to lose and I won. The other thing that I think about is, you know, we're in this time of extreme negative partisanship. Views of both political parties are very negative. People seem to be driven more by opposition to the other side, by support for their own side. And of course, Trump managed to win this election with really terrible favorability numbers. He still cobbled together enough votes to win. So I guess, does Trump need good numbers? How bad should we think of these poll numbers as being for him?
There's a really fascinating study that I believe Gallup put together where they looked at presidential job approval in the first 100 days or so of presidents going back decades. And what they found was when they split out the results, looking at those who were of the new president's party, those of the opposition party, and those who were independents, that you've seen people nowadays, if you are in the party of the president who just took office, you still tend to overwhelmingly like him. 90% favorables, 90% approval ratings. What has changed, and it did not start with Trump, but has really become much more extreme under Trump, is the extent to which the opposition party does not really give him a chance. That, you know, you typically back during the JFK sorts of eras, you know, you would have folks from the opposition party, still a majority, saying, look, at the beginning, we'll give him a chance. We'll approve of the job he's doing. Whereas from day one of the Trump presidency, only about 9% of the Democratic Party has said they've approved of the job he's done. Under Obama, it was a very small percentage of Republicans who right from the get-go said that they approved of the job he was doing. So what we've had is now nobody really gets a honeymoon period. Everybody just sort of starts off with their own partisans backing them strongly, but the opposition party not giving them a chance at all, which has led to Donald Trump's approval numbers being mediocre, but also remarkably stable considering how chaotic the last few months have felt.
Margie, in that context, how do you feel about Democrats' chances in next year's elections? I mean, we've seen generic ballot polling that has Democrats up by, you know, what is it, close to 10 points in the congressional elections, but they would need to win by a lot. And then what Kristen describes there, I think, raises questions about how much more support there is for them to pick up, right?
Well, so there are a few things to take a look at. I mean, first, historically, the party out of power does quite well in midterms. And certainly, if you look at the specials, while, of course, it's been a bummer for Democrats, the technical term, bummer, to not win any of the specials, still you had Democrats really overperforming based on the partisan breakouts of those districts, which suggests that there's a lot of enthusiasm and room for Democrats to move some seats and pick up some seats. The question, I think, when we're looking at the national trends is not simply what are Trump's approval ratings or his favorability overall or with Republicans, because for sure, there's no more room to grow with Democrats. Democrats are fully consolidated against the president and to pick up seats. But with independents and with Republicans, I think there's still some room there for folks to move away from him. And if it's not in the overall numbers, it's certainly in some of the things beneath the surface, things like, is the president reckless? Is he Does he make you proud? Is he behaving well? Does he have the right temperament? Is he keeping his promises? That's a different measure, one that he's been weak on. If he can't string together some wins on issues that people actually agree with him on, then he's open to the attack, a well-founded attack, that he's spending too much time on, you know, tweets and all the things that are related to the tweets, as opposed to actually getting things done for the country. So if you look at that, that's a way that he may really lose some support with his own base, or with folks who maybe weren't excited. They were reluctant Trump voters. They weren't necessarily enthusiastic Trump voters. And they may decide to sit out this time around.
But then enthusiasm also plays on the other side. And Kristen, I know your business partner, Patrick Ruffini, has been talking a lot lately about sort of asymmetrical enthusiasm on the Democratic side, looking both at polling and at precinct by precinct results from some of these special elections. And he tweeted the other day that the resistance is basically purely a college educated white phenomenon. And then when you look in these districts, you know, Democrats are doing a really good job of turning out college educated white Democrats, not doing so well either at drawing back working class whites or at goosing turnout among non-white voters. Do you see that phenomenon? Do you think that that's something that sort of protects Republicans in next year's elections?
Well, I think that's part of why anytime you're looking at national numbers, when we're talking about House elections, there's limited utility there, because there will be certain districts where you will have a very high proportion of exactly the types of voters that Democrats may have wished turned out in 2016 but stayed home, but that they will be able to activate this time around and that Republicans need to be ready for. But that will not be every swing district. And so I do think that Republicans at this point, going into these midterms, you know, as Margie mentioned, there are all sorts of historical trends that suggest this should be an absolute nightmare for Republicans. And yet right now, you know, I've heard a great analogy by a Republican strategist, Alex Castellanos, has used this before, that sometimes voters look at an election as a brake pedal, that they see things happening in Washington and they feel like there's pedal to the metal, the accelerator is down and the car is going in the wrong direction. Or in this case with President Trump, you have a driver who's tweeting while driving. And you may just want to have a brake pedal there to stop the car. But it's not clear to me yet that voters' frustration with Washington is that Washington is doing too much that they don't like, so much as the fact that there is not enough happening at all, that Washington does seem to be stopped on the side of the road, not doing anything for the American people. So if the Democratic message is vote for us because you will certainly get gridlock in Washington for at least 2 years, it's unclear to me how compelling that message is, and that may wind up being a saving grace for Republicans.
Well, we've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
President Trump tweeted a doctored video of himself from his old bygone WWE days, body slamming someone with a CNN logo superimposed on his head. This was juvenile and obviously highly unpresidential, but it wasn't a physical threat against the press. Just because Trump is an unhinged tweeter, it doesn't mean that everyone else has to lose their good sense and sense of proportion.
Katrina Vandenhoevel.
Nearly 6 months into Trump's presidency, we hit July 4th. It seemed important to reflect on the meaning of patriotism. The great late Texas columnist Molly Ivins liked to say, "Patriotism is best expressed in our works, not our parades. We are the heirs of the most magnificent political legacy any people has ever been given." And it's in that struggle. The struggle today has taken on a renewed sense of urgency. Efforts to gut health care, environmental protections, roll back voting rights are a full-blown assault on the rights envisioned in the Declaration of Independence. Yet, it's inspiring to see millions of people confronting those threats, engaging in the political process, many for the first time. And remember, when you're feeling blue, we're seeing the hard work of patriotism flourishing all around us.
Juliette Kayyem.
A few years ago, Republican senators sent an unprecedented letter to the Iranian leadership during really tense and tough negotiations on the Iran deal that were ongoing with the Obama administration. That letter violated a sort of consistent history that when speaking abroad, the United States only has one voice. Critics of that move from the left should be equally critical of New York Mayor Bill de Blasio's quick visit to the G20, at least on the sidelines, to make his presence known. We may not like America's voice right now. We may be critical of some of the policies. But when we are talking abroad, a consistent message is something that historically has benefited both Democrats and Republicans.
Margie O'Meara.
So I want to talk about cross-party unity. I'm definitely not talking about Democrats becoming more moderate on things like equality or opportunity. And I'm not talking about Republicans becoming more moderate, although that'd be nice, of course, or at least that's my point of view. But I'm talking about finding an area where we agree. And it may be that we have to start with Donald Trump's tweets. Half of Republicans say they think the president should stop tweeting. Even Republicans feel his tweets are inappropriate. So I know that talking about Trump's tweets can be a bit exhausting, but maybe we should try to use them for good as a starting point of a conversation, because we may not all agree on tax cuts or immigration, but we can mostly agree that we should be able to have civil conversations with our neighbors and have a president who's sober and wise rather than coarse and impulsive.
Kristen Soltis Anderson.
The latest fairly silly controversy gripping Capitol Hill at the moment is about dress code. It's very warm here in Washington at the moment, and a female reporter from the Right of Center Weekly Standard was denied entry to the Speaker's lobby in the House of Representatives for wearing a dress that did not have sleeves. Now, there has been a dress code that has been around for decades. It has been in place through speakers, male and female, Democratic and Republican. But nonetheless, this has created a bit of a firestorm, with various publications alleging this is Paul Ryan attempting to impose some kind of theocratic conservative rule on women. This frustrates me because I think there are important debates to be had over things like fair pay for women, over access to things like contraception, where there are important debates to be had. And instead, many publications, I think, have beclowned themselves by alleging that this silly piece of dress code, which is neither Paul Ryan's own policy nor something that I think is exclusive to women — men are required to wear jackets and ties as well when they enter the Speaker's lobby. This has been a very silly controversy that I think is part of why many people who are on the right say they have skepticism of the media.
For my rant, Steve Bannon, of all people, has been pushing a good idea inside the White House. We saw reports this week that he's pushing for the Republican tax reform plan to raise the top marginal tax rate on earned income above 40%. Currently, it's 39.6%. Henry alluded in today's show to the idea that Trump's working class supporters may feel betrayed if what he hands down is a big tax cut for the rich rather than for the middle class. A big way to show that solidarity would be to explicitly raise, even by a little bit, the tax rate at the top. If you did that, you could even draw some Democratic support for a plan that also included significant cuts in the corporate income tax. That said, this seems to be just Steve Bannon's idea, and the people who are actually writing the tax plan seem keen on significantly lowering that rate. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Katrina Vandenhoevel, Juliet Kayyem, Henry Olson, and the pollsters Margie O'Meara and Kristen Soltis Anderson. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins is our production assistant. Special thanks to Todd M. Simon, who composed our new theme music. I am Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.